This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found Cyber Frontiers, show number 28, which almost never happened, recorded on June 6th, 2016. Here on Cyber Frontiers, we explore cybersecurity, big data, and the technologies that are shaping the future, all from an academic perspective. I'm your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios. Here in a warm summer is almost here, Bellevue, Nebraska, and of course we post the show with world-class show notes out at theaverageguy.tv. If you have questions during the program, we do have a live chat room that's available for you, but if you'd like to send those in, you can contact us. Send us an email, jim@theaverageguy.tv. You can find me on Twitter, at jcollison, or you can just join us live. That'd be a great way to do it. Christian, hopefully, will have another one after this, so congratulations on getting out to number 28. Before we bring in, let me just say, we're still powered by Maple Grove Partners, right? Secure, reliable, high-speed hosting for people you know and trust. You might know one of those guys. MapleGrovePartners.com. Hosting plans, especially great for podcasters, as cheap as $10 a month. Check it out, MapleGrovePartners.com. And now Cyber Frontiers is a part of the Geeks Network. Find this show and many other great podcasts, including a really good home server show, which Dave McCabe did the other day, out at the geeksnetwork.com. All right, Christian, I checked the calendar. It's been a while. We are back. Good to be back. Welcome back to another Cyber Frontiers.
Thanks. Yeah, no, it's great to be back. And I feel like the more I read the news and the more I see what we did in the first 27 shows, the more I'm convinced we're on the right track here. So it's nice to finally have the time to get back to doing this. And I'm looking forward to bringing some new content, stuff we haven't talked about. I mean, we've talked about it, but not in quite the context we're going to tonight. And so also with show 28, we're bringing on a new co-host, Waruna, who is a student at the University of Maryland in the ACES program with me. So Waruna, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we thought tonight we would really dive into anonymity, and specifically what is Tor? Because I keep getting this question a lot, and it's time to make a podcast about it. When you start, you know, there's like a threshold equation. If question's greater than 5 and question is the same, then make podcasts. So we're applying that law here. And we're also really taking a look at the technologies that power something called the dark web, which I get even more questions about. And so, you know, this will really be and kind of a bit of an academic deep dive context into how all this stuff came about, what the actual technology stack is, and hopefully we'll tie it back into some of those more kind of common buzzwords around the topics of Tor, anonymity, dark web, kind of all the things people feel like are dark and sexy, but they really have no idea what they're talking about. That's going to be this podcast. So,
Christian, how many people do you think really, I mean, the numbers when we think about those things, how many, is it a handful? Is it hundreds, thousands? Who knows the real truth on some of
them? Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's kind of like a scaled thing. So out of your general population, the number of people who actually have heard the term dark web before, probably 3 years ago would have been a really small number. I think now it's probably a lot larger. So let's say maybe somewhere between 25 and 40% of people surveyed would say, yeah, I've heard the word dark web. How many people could actually define it for you in a way that's correct? Probably less than 5% of those people. And really the people who can define it the best are those who either have studied it, used it extensively, are security experts in industry, etc. It's really one of those things where you can understand it from a like a kind of a user populist type of definition, or from a really technical understanding of going back to the technologies. Some of the original papers written on this stuff really was actually happened in the 70s, right? So people think dark web is this brand new thing, which in many ways in the way it exists today, it is. But a lot of the original concepts that came into being that made this possible, that was a conversation that started a long time ago. And so That's where we're going to start tonight and then kind of move forward. But yeah, it's a pretty small number. Hopefully most of the people in the security community can at least do some credence to giving the proper definition, but there's definitely some people who get it wrong there too. So,
all right, let's dig right in.
So here's the litmus test. We're going to ask Waruna tonight what he thinks the Tor network is, what his definition, if he had to surmise it, of anonymity is, and maybe what are the top one or two things that people find important about anonymity on the internet.
Right, so Tor is essentially a free software. It's built on Firefox, and pretty much the way it works is through something called onion routing, which is essentially you have an endpoint and an endpoint, and someone enters through the endpoint, and pretty much the traffic gets bounced around through a volunteer system of networks all over the world and goes through the exit. The core concept is that each point only knows where the traffic is coming from and where it's going to. And when you pass it through enough nodes, the idea behind it is that the original source and the final destination is kind of hidden unless you are at the exit node. So obviously the greatest application of this is that people that either want to make sure that their web browsing is hidden or maybe want to use it for criminal activities obviously find this a very, very good source to go to. The biggest things obviously that come up is obviously the criminal aspects of it and also how effective is it. And you know, there's been numerous studies that have attempted to kind of break the entire Tor network and trying to make sure, trying to exploit it. And those have had, you know, numerous millions upon millions of dollars poured into that. And essentially, in this day and age where privacy is becoming a huge concern, Tor has a huge, huge impact on almost, you know, everything we do today.
And if you had to define anonymity in 1 to 2 sentences, what would you say?
Anonymity in itself would kind of be having the freedom to do what you want to do with as minimum of a privacy leak as possible. So very few people, or if possible, no people would know about what you're doing, and you would be free to do what you want without any concern of outside prying.
Sure. Jim, how about you? Anonymity.
To be able to, starting with that same definition, of being able to kind of do what you want without being known or being identified as an individual.
Sure, sure. So both solid definitions. And this kind of summary of the Tor network that Waruna just gave us will kind of put some building blocks there to get to there. But definitely when we're talking about Tor, when we're talking about the dark web, everything has to start with what is anonymity, because you can't get to the technical understanding of how these protocols were designed if you don't have a good understanding of anonymity. So really, you know, what you said is both correct, but there are two types of anonymity that we really look for in the security community. One is called sender anonymity, the other is receiver anonymity. They should be pretty self-explanatory from those terms, but essentially, if I want sender anonymity, that means that I, as the sender, do not want to be identified when I send a message to an individual. Likewise, with receiver anonymity, they might want to be able to receive messages from many people, but not be able to be identified in the process. And so this is really important, because these are the two types of anonymity you can have. And really, when we think about the internet, if we think about the internet as a series of messages between parties, these definitions are highly important. So a lot of what we'll talk about is in the context of a message. That message could be a website. It could be an email message. It could be anything. Think of a message as content. And so when we look at sender and receiver anonymity, it's really talking about what properties of sending and receiving a message is anonymous from whose perspective. The Tor network really allows us to do both, and that's one of the big things and the big advantages that attract both individuals and entities, where we'll just for now define entities as two or more people. That's really what makes Tor so powerful, because it's really the first kind of accessible and comprehensive platform where individuals can send messages without much of a performance degradation, and get both of these properties of sender and receiver anonymity. And what this really can be traced back to is this idea of non-repudiation, right? So in cryptography, non-repudiation is the idea that if I send you a message, you can say for certain that this was the person who sent it and no one else tampered with the encrypted message. That's non-repudiation. That's saying, I see this message and the signature is valid. That means that, you know, this person definitely is the person who sent it and no one else could have forged that message. In the Tor framework, what we really want is the opposite of that. We want repudiation in the sense that we want to be able to say, hey, I don't know who sent this, or I don't know how I got this message. It could have came from anyone. Likewise, we might want to be able to send a message and someone wouldn't necessarily be able to point the finger at you and say, hey, did you send this to me? Right? So that's the idea of repudiation. And so prior to the Tor network, however, the real technology that kind of started this whole conversation was either in the late 70s, early 80s, I need to brush up on the date, but it was called the MixNet protocol. The MixNet protocol is really the precursor of a lot of the improvements that you see that make the Tor routing protocol possible. And so with a MixNet, there's a similar idea. It's this idea that I'm a client, I want to get a message to someone. How can I get a message to someone without them knowing that I sent it? Well, in the MixNet model, you have at least three different layers of compute infrastructure. So let's just say there are other nodes that can send and receive messages. So I'm going to take my message. I am going to encrypt my message with a public key of the first layer, and I'm going to send it. So basically, the first layer receives my message, and the first layer is the only thing that can decrypt my message because I encrypted it with their data. So now, this first layer has the responsibility of forwarding it on to the second layer. The second layer has the responsibility of forwarding it on to the third layer. And then the third layer has the responsibility of forwarding it to its final destination. The whole idea here is that we're trying to stop a passive observer, or basically someone who could sniff the network and say, hey, I see that Jim is sending an email to John, right? And so the way that this, the whole idea behind the MixNet is that we're looking to create a sense of confusion in the network where it's kind of hard to tell who's sending what when. So MixNet's introduced a fundamental idea of junk packets, where at each layer, it constantly is sending out random messages that mean absolutely nothing to no one. And in the midst of sending out these random messages at random intervals, it also sends out your real message at some point. So the first layer is doing that at the sending it to the second layer. The second layer is doing it to the third layer. And the idea here is that by having this mix of constantly sending different packets at random intervals between the layers, it would be very hard for a passive observer who's watching the network to be able to look at the traffic and see where your message is going and who it's intended for. So that's really important. And the other neat thing is that using encryption technologies, one layer can only receive the message from the previous layer that encrypted it for that particular layer. And what I really mean by layer is just a series of computers, essentially, where the first layer picks a random computer and the second layer to deal with the traffic. That's this idea of randomly mixing the message. The Tor network, however, takes a very, very different approach to this concept, but it's built off the same pillars. So Tor also has three layers. It has an entry node, the first layer. It has a middle layer, the second layer. And it has an exit node, which is the third layer. What's different about Tor, however, is it's not, the idea here is not about mixing things up or making things confusing or putting in randomness. With Tor, the assumption is that it can prove that at some point the message didn't go through a certain network that the passive observer would be able to look at. And so Tor doesn't implement junk packets, so it's not sending out random traffic. It also will immediately forward or send your message as soon as the layer receives it. Whereas in a mixnet, it's going to hold on to your message. It's going to try and send it out at a random time to confuse someone who might be passively observing it. And this is actually really well surmised in a paragraph that will be included in the show notes that really talks to great length with kind of some pictures that make this super easy to understand the difference. But the blog says, mixed networks get their security from the mixing done by their component mixes and may or may not use route unpredictably to enhance security. Onion routing, on the other hand, networks primarily by getting their security from choosing routes that are difficult for the adversary to observe, which for designs deployed to date has meant choosing unpredictable routes through a network. And onion routers typically employ no mixing at all. This gets at the essence of the two, even if it's a bit quick on both sides. Mixes are usually intended to resist an adversary that can observe all traffic everywhere, and in some threat models, to actively change traffic. Onion routing assumes that an adversary who observes both ends of a communication path will completely break the anonymity of its traffic. Thus, onion routing networks are designed to resist a local adversary, one that can only see a subset of the network and the traffic on it. So the idea here is that, unlike a mixnet, where it doesn't matter if you're observing the whole part of the network or a portion of the network, you're going to have trouble figuring out what's going on. In Tor, however, technically the threat model is that if you could observe the entire network from beginning to end in Tor, you would technically be able to compromise it. So the idea behind Tor is that you're picking a route that you can guarantee that the client doesn't have complete access to and the receiver doesn't have complete access to. And so this really allows us to build now a model that does both sender and receiver anonymity. And here's the context. With sender anonymity, we basically want to be able to do the typical types of things that would be associated with, like, sending an encrypted email message. Maybe you want to send a password securely to someone who's, you know, sitting somewhere else. That's encryption, right? But that's not really anonymity. So with anonymity, it's this idea of, you know, maybe you want to report a bug, or maybe you want to get a message to someone and, you know, you don't want to be personally affiliated with it. It's just kind of a third party, hey, here's a heads up type deal. That would be a great example of sender anonymity. But what's really powerful here is receiver anonymity, and that's kind of the framework for what builds the dark web. So, Jim, what do you think the dark web is?
Well, you know, this, Christian, I don't know. I mean, from an average guy perspective, I think it's the place where people go to do all kinds of, you know, things they shouldn't be doing, right? I think when most people think of the dark web, they think of you know, mischief and hacking.
Okay. How about you, Aruna?
So my definition, I guess, the dark web would be a collection of websites not publicly accessible, but through specific software. For example, it used to be Tor before supposedly it was compromised. That would make it possible to reach these websites where different things would go on. You know, some people have it for, you know, black market trading and so forth.
Sure. So both touch on relevant pieces. Really, one of the great distinctions here is the difference between the dark web and the deep web. Really, the deep web is anything that you can't access through a normal search engine, right? Which really is a lot of stuff, right? You're not going to use a search engine to get to a database server that helps power a website, right? Technically, that's considered part of the deep web. It's something that helps power and run the web, but it's not something that you're just going to search, boom, and there it is. Or it's not a resource that you consume directly. It might be something that helps build it. With the dark web, we're specifically going back to this definition of receiver anonymity. And this is what's so important. It's this idea that websites can be accessible by receivers, or excuse me, websites can be accessible by clients, but you can't figure out where that website lives in the world. So it's not like I can look up the IP address of the server and say, oh, this IP address is in this ASN, and I see it's coming from, you know, Bogota, Colombia, right? Which if it's a normal website, if it has a DNS name like google.com, I can go do a DNS lookup for, hey, what's google.com resolved to? It's going to give me an IP address, and it's going to say, boom, okay, I see, now it's in California, right? That's quite the opposite of anonymity, right? It's basically we can directly look it up and see who's behind this content that I'm receiving. What the dark web really allows you to do, and what this protocol really allows you to do, is to create content and websites that are still accessible like you would on the internet, but you can't really trace it because it's taking advantage of the Tor protocol to mask its own identity. So now we start to mix the idea of it's not necessarily people that we're masking the identity of, it's systems that we're masking the identity of. So the server that wants to serve a web page can basically communicate to one of the Tor layers, hey, I exist over here. And a client on the other side of that layer can say, hey, I'm looking for content about this. And the middle layer in those routes are going to basically create a route where the two converge so they can meet up at a common middle ground point. This is almost like Pirates of the Caribbean when they do parlay and Jack Sparrow's going on one end and I don't remember who the other person is, but they're going on the other end. That's what this is. This is parlay. Traditional pirate scallywag style. And so the website content brings it halfway, the client brings it halfway, and so whether it's a MixNet or Tor, really Tor is what allows you to build these routes where that layer is going to send content back to the user and back to the website that allows for normal networking, but at the same time doesn't compromise the identity of either person in many cases. And so this is really cool in the sense that you can still have search engines on the dark web on the Tor network, and they do. There's a lot of search engines that you can access through Tor that are basically, they're under the same model, but they know, like, okay, these list of websites have this type of content, and so you can search for that, but you're still not going to be able to search your way to figuring out kind of who's behind the curtain, so to speak. And in that way, it also reminds me of The Wizard of Oz and the Green Curtain, and it's kind of some of that. But that really kind of establishes the principles of the dark web. So when people tell me from now on, what is the dark web, it's really kind of explaining two things. It's explaining this idea of sender and receiver anonymity. It's giving them maybe a high-level definition of how these routing protocols may work, maybe a really high-level definition, and then what the applications of it are. But as you mentioned, Aruna, obviously a lot of what this can be facilitated for is criminal activity, which has been, really well documented in the media. Probably the biggest example being the Silk Road was run on these types of technologies for a long time. And the Silk Road is really just kind of your ultimate black market on that's accessible throughout the globe. So that's kind of the level of scope that this has. And so the question is open on the floor for you, Aruna, and then for Jim. What types of, protections or advancements could the technology possibly make in reducing that type of activity? And how do you really build secure standards without compromising certain aspects of what make them true secure standards?
Right. So as you mentioned, some of the services that are criminal in their nature, like you said, usually are listed on a certain search engine specific to Tor. So obviously the first step would be to kind of make sure that the websites that are accessible through the Tor search engines are those that do not engage in criminal activities. Now, of course, the problem is that Tor itself being, Tor being limited in its resources might not be able to efficiently make sure that every single website that, Tor has access to is, following all the rules. And also, the pure number of people that just go on Tor for those activities is massive, and making sure that, every single website is shut down is just a massive you know, time-consuming task.
Sure. Sure. What do you think, Jim?
I don't think you can, to be honest with you. It's like an amoeba. You know, you squeeze in on one side, and the other side pops out. And the criminals, or even, you know, it's not always a crime that's being done, but folks who want to remain anonymous or want to do those kinds of things will always be that way, and they'll always find loopholes. I mean, I think sometimes it goes back to that same argument of security versus convenience, and, you know, the only way to really handle it or deal with it is to shut it off, and of course we can't. The cat's out of the bag, right, from this standpoint. So I think we can monitor it. I think we can highlight it. I think we can work on it. I think the various governments can do some things to slow it down or reduce the target, you know, as you like to say, reduce the target, what's the
attack surface.
Attack surface. There we go. But I don't think you'll ever, I don't think, it's just, it's too big. There's too much stuff going on. I just don't know if you can really effectively do much.
Yeah, and you know, I think this is really, encryption for the longest time has been like the classic model of this, you know, this argument where it's like, okay, encryption allows good people to do a lot of really good things. It allows bad people to do a lot of bad things. So do you compromise the integrity of the protocol to try and go after bad people, or do you let the protocol stand on the principles of being something that's supposed to be a secure protocol? So it definitely raises a lot of interesting questions. It definitely surprises me, I think, that as many people are starting to ask questions about the dark web. And again, I think it's more about this piece of it seems cool, bad, sexy, whatever. But a lot of what surprises me that folks are missing here is think about if the whole internet was this model to begin with. I mean, we grew up in an internet where it was a very public place once you got on it, and things were very routable and very visible. But, you know, have we ever imagined a world where the internet started as a place where this was the protocol, where it did have all these anonymity features? And so I kind of wonder if the conversation would be different if we kind of lived in an internet where anonymity was an expectation, not a feature.
Yeah, I wonder what Vint would say about this. You know, as he envisioned the internet, I think, you know, certainly the internet began with some military intent, right? There were, they were connecting things together and being able to route those things and you know, being able to route this traffic. And of course, it went public. It went public pretty well. It went public pretty fast, right? Once we started really getting it in the 90s, it went really, really fast. Although it was around in its various forms for 15 or 20 years before that. But yeah, it's Christian, I think it's a great question. I think, you know, the public thinks the internet is open by nature. I mean, we just see that when you think about it. Everybody, no, I shouldn't say everybody, these are broad strokes, right? But I think a lot of people came to the internet in the 90s and early 2000s, the assumption is that it would be completely open, right? So I think if we think about a hidden or a dark, I think that's really foreign for a lot of people. They kind of, I don't know. I don't know what that means. Isn't everything that's ever been done, I mean, can I find my genealogy, you know, on the web? So I think it implies an openness to it. But to your point about encryption, you know, so we came up with encryption. Any of those things that are good can always be used, right? That's just the way it is. But we've got to continue to have faith, I think, that some of these things are going to work.
Sure. Yeah, and I think one of the big things that blows my mind is that more people, I think a big population of the people who use Tor are using it because they are privacy conscious and they're tired of the third party tracking, the cookie model, I call them the little leeches that just keep living on your computer, and it really becomes a parasite after a bit. Where, you know, I'm in the habit now of, you know, whenever my browser completely closes, all the cookies get wiped. Because think about it, what was the one thing that cookies were supposed to be great for? One thing: I don't want to have to type in my password anymore. Yeah. Well, guess what? Now everyone has, you know, LastPass and RoboForm, and your computer automatically puts in that password in anyway. So, okay, if we took away that purpose of the cookie, what's left? Remember user settings? Remember it on the server. Don't remember it on my computer. Okay, that's gone. What's left? tracking where you go throughout the internet so that we can give you highly relevant targeted ads and content for shopping. Yeah, that's left. So, yeah,
but still, that's not very effective. I mean,
You think?
I know. I don't think it. Well, if it wasn't that effective, they would just stop doing it. So it has to have some. It has to be effective in some.
So it's got to be $1 billion market.
Yeah, maybe so.
What do you think?
Yeah, and the thing with, you know, what Christian was mentioning, most people don't necessarily want to use it for criminal purposes. But when we especially look at the media, there isn't going to be a story about how people are, you know, using Tor to protect their privacy or using Tor to make sure that they're stalkers and still looking for them. Media often portrays Tor and, you know, especially the dark web and the deep web. They usually point their, most of the attention is shed on the fact that it's used for criminal activities, and that's the part that gets the most attention. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people have usually assume, you know, Tor means criminal, and they kind of, you know, ignore the entire other aspects. And it's interesting because, you know, since studies that have been done show that, you know, since last year or, you know, since a few years ago, people have been moving from, you know, doing criminal activities like drug trading or black market trading for weapons, and they've been going more and more towards just using Tor for privacy needs rather than the criminal aspects.
Yeah.
No, right. I think you make a great point. I mean, I'm thinking more and more people, as this gets easier, are looking at it as just personal security, as just limiting that attack surface, of just narrowing things down. Other Jim says in chat, hey, what if we only could write postcards and the ideas of having envelopes were strange? And that's, you know, what if everything was open to the public, like in a postcard, and we had no, you know, I think it's a great analogy. We had no idea, oh, hey, there's these envelopes that actually hide what you're saying. I think that's a good analogy. You know, we only think in that we think in both terms, but a good point.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the other interesting aspect about that analogy too, is, okay, so I'm only going to use a postcard, but I'm going to write a bunch of gibberish on the postcard that only one person understands. Is that an envelope?
Yeah. Well, it kind of, that reminds me of the old spy days, you know, and you come up with these, you know, they'd write these letters, but they would have these things for figuring them out, you know, because they would assume, gosh, so many of these things are so similar, you know, they would assume that this stuff was going to be read, and so they found ways to hide things in the letters through whatever source they would do. And so it's interesting, I think encryption ties into that a little bit. We just assume now, well, it's all going to be read, so encrypt it all.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. And the other, the whole thing that kind of amazes me about this, too, is you know what the other big side of this whole anonymity aspect that most people, I think everyone just gravitates to, what's an anonymous way to go on the internet? Tor. But realistically, a lot of people who know something about a computer, the first answer before Tor was not Tor. It was use a VPN. And use a VPN that you don't own, you don't operate, is not linked to any computing gear that you have, and you're paying a subscription for. And that's a really interesting, a ton of VPNs out there. I know, because when I have to block form abusers on websites, it's a pain to block VPNs because they just pop up at new IP addresses all the time. But think about that. Virtual private networks, they were around for much longer before really Tor became any kind of popular service. And while VPNs are a very different technology, and I'm not saying that VPNs are synonymous with Tor because the technologies are very different, but some of the end goals are very similar. A secure way to compute from a network that is not the one you're currently on. It achieves that in a very different manner. The guarantees about what types of anonymity are available are also different, but that's really another way of seeing the picture. And I think this is proven in something we're going to look at next week when we do a product review on a device called the Anonabox Pro. ANONABOX.com. And Anonabox really kind of shows that those two things are definitely a converged technology, because this box is essentially acts as this pocket-sized, I mean, it's not anything bigger than like a credit card, really. Yeah, there it is right there on screen. And so it's pocket-sized, and it has both Tor routing and premium VPN services. So it's this idea that this little, it's a pocket-sized router, essentially. And what it lets you do is a bunch of wireless clients, you know, your laptops or whatever, can connect to the router like you would an ordinary router. But this router is already either logged into the VPN or logged into the Tor network. So all of your traffic is getting automatically forwarded over those different mediums without you having to install the specific softwares and the things that puts your computer on the network. Instead, the router is doing all that for you, and you're just getting this nice, pretty connection that has these certain guarantees that we've talked about. Of course, that's at least the way I understand it based on reading and market language. We're actually going to install this device this week and do some testing on it. And so part of the reason for having this conversation is not just because it's highly relevant to questions I'm getting, but also it allows us to take a look at some of the products that are in this space and see, are these things that consumers really care about? I think one of the good indicators of how true that is how well this product is going to do. If a lot of people are buying this product, it's a sign that the average consumer does actually care about privacy to some degree, or at least having these capabilities. So that is going to be an interesting metric for us to watch, I think.
Yeah. Christian, what do you think? Do you think the average consumer, just when we think about the work necessary to go through to be anonymous or to at least protect their content, are they doing a pretty good job, or what do you think most are lacking?
I think the barrier to adopting and understanding these technologies has continued to improve, but I don't think it's necessarily just readily there. So I think boxes like this might make it a lot easier for consumers to have a low barrier. Hey, this product's going to get me from point A to Z on how to do this. People who are like everyone has their, DIY handyman around that can kind of tinker around and figure things out. A lot of people who have that kind of mindset would have probably not a lot of difficulty figuring out how to download stuff like a VPN or a Tor client and working with it. There's a lot of people who probably just don't care, to be honest. I think what's more interesting at this point is among the people who do care to some degree, how many of them are finding barriers and figuring out how to use the technology in a way that works well for them. I think that's the big question, because we've pretty well scouted out how many folks are caring about privacy. We've talked a lot on this show about how many people are even cognizant of big data in the context of cookies and tracking and all the information they're giving up for free. As we say, information is a currency in the digital age, which is why you can get T-shirts at data conferences that say data is the new bacon, and you've seen me wear this shirt sometimes. So it's of the people who know that data is bacon, how many people are eating the bacon and how many people are saying, no thanks, I'll have scrambled eggs. So that's if we have to put it in a breakfast analogy, that's how we're going
to
do it.
And who doesn't like to put everything in a breakfast?
Or a breakfast burrito, even better.
Rightly so. So in you said a week or two, maybe, whatever we decide to do, we'll come back. And I assume you got yours. We'll say full disclosure, Anonybox has sent these out to us for review. And, of course, I've used mine. I really find them handy. We'll talk about them the next time we're on, though.
Yeah.
When we do this. Christian, what do you think, when we think about priorities of computing for people, and we think of the one priority of surfing the web anonymously or even safely, right, being able to do banking transactions and those kinds of things safely, versus the malware virus landscape, what's a greater threat to us at this point?
Yeah, I think for the consumer, it's definitely, the average Joe doesn't know much about technology. It's about keeping the PC virus free. I think that's a very big generalization, though, because I see a lot of the things we're talking about in terms of these technologies. This would be for, more targeted attacks. So, if a hacker wants to break into a bank and get all the money, these are the types of things that are going to make or break whether or not that bank is secure, right? What's the most important thing for a bank when you're talking to it? No one should be able to look at the network and see what your balance is. No one should be able to sniff the network and figure out how the bank is authenticating you. No one should be able to mimic your login and get to your bank account and then drain it. So when we talk about you know, both of these things matter to the user, right? They don't want their bank account drained. They also want to keep their PC clean so that they don't have passwords stolen or otherwise. So from like a, I am a user and I'm using this computer, I think the big battle for the average consumer is staying virus-free, staying on clean sites, learning how to navigate the internet safely. From the other flip coin of that, I think the people who are providing services to consumers, you know, banks, insurance companies, healthcare, these types of services that are very common, everyone's using them every day, the providers are worrying about that much more because their services and their credibility as a company relies on how well they understand these principles and apply them to their products. Obviously, a company is still going to care deeply if their one of their machines in their intranet gets infected with a virus, because essentially that puts them at the same level of risk for, you know, things happening. But I think definitely you start to see a converged model where for the consumer, both really matters, one they're passively engaging with and one they're actively engaging with. Would you agree with that characterization, Aruna?
Yeah, so for me, I'd say the obviously losing the computer or whatever machine is a pretty big loss. I'd say in this age where simple set of numbers, say your social security number or, you know, your driver's license or your bank numbers have such a potential to impact your life, it's with things like, you know, identity theft or losing a lot of money. I'd say those threats are definitely might have a little bigger impact than losing a machine, but at the same time, it really depends on what kind of viruses and malware that do infect your PC. For example, there's, you know, malware that CryptoLocker was one of them where, you know, it just encrypts everything, demands money, it essentially you lose all your data. And that's easy to combat if you have everything backed up. But if a virus essentially starts sending out all your private information, that information might be much, much more, that information might harm your life much more. Just the fact that you've now lost your PC. So I'd say it really depends on the context of, you know, what virus we're talking about and what personal information is.
Christian, this week or last week, there's been big problems with TeamViewer. And, and I was actually in on that. Initially, I had thought I had just mistakenly left the password in the clear, or did something where I'd done something wrong. Come to find out that it's been a systemic problem with TeamViewer, where there are people, you know, and that's a huge, when you think about that surface, like, you know, I just left that up and running all the time.
And somebody, I still do sometimes.
Yeah, no, right on. Somebody came right in, and of course, once they have that level of access, right, it's like they're there. I mean, one step, boom, and they are in.
So, Jim, can you explain that? So when it happened to you, what was it? You noticed someone had logged into your computer using it?
You know, the screens that you get when you close out TeamViewer, they were on both PCs. And I only access TeamViewer from this PC, and when I'm done, I click that screen off, right? And so it was like, that's not good, And come to find out, the biggest complaints have been around Amazon and PayPal, and those were the two things they hit very quickly. Now, two things that I use to help me: one is TeamViewer, two is LastPass. And of course, when they're on your desktop, LastPass is a liability, not a benefit, right, for you at that point. And so they dug in. Now, they were, I mentioned this on Home Gadget Geeks, they were really, really poor criminals if they were doing this from that standpoint, because they didn't do anything right. I mean, I was able to myself recover everything they took to the tune of about $800 or $900. So not insignificant, but I was able to get all that back because they were just really bad about the way they did it. But the point being that attack surface was gigantic. Wasn't aware of it. They were able to get in. They're continuing to do it. A TeamViewer is struggling today to be able to figure out, okay, how did this happen and how do they get in and how they do it? So it was just interesting. Two things that I use a lot of. I've gotten in the habit now. I just turn it off when I'm done. I mean, I'm turning it off. You can't. And then I started two-factor, which I didn't know TeamViewer had until I thought, oh, it'd be nice if TeamViewer had two-factor, and of course it does, using a Google Authenticator to get that done. So, you know, that's one of those areas where you think, oh, I got this all buttoned down, and then a service as critical as TeamViewer lets you down, and they're right in.
And so okay, this is fascinating to me. So they had to figure out, well, they randomly guessed your computer ID, right? And in your case, what was it? Did you have unattended access set up? Is that
yes.
the password they breached, or is it the four-digit PIN?
No, it was the password that they must have breached. My password. They must have gotten a hold of my password from TeamViewer themselves or something, and then began to come in. I mean, who knows? I'm not exactly sure. You can go to TeamViewer.com, and of course, you can log in with your account there. They've got a login that. You know, that's kind of where I went to say, hey, what's going on here, and how's this working, and, you know, immediately changed the password, and then turned on two-factor, and got that up and running. But to this day, I still don't know how they got the master password for TeamViewer. They had to have gotten it from somewhere, because it's not easy to guess. So it had to be compromised somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? No, that's fascinating.
And it's happening to enough people that it's not like they got my username and password from another account somewhere and then took it to TeamViewer, although that would be a really smart thing to do. But I am pretty sure it had to have come from TeamViewer, which is a little scary and makes me want to say to everybody, turn on two-factor. If you're not using two-factor on TeamViewer, you better be.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. No, I actually, funnily enough. Franz, who's been on the show in the past, was all over this earlier in the week about we used to joke that because a lot of us used it a lot for different stuff, and so he'd say, I don't know, man, that stuff's not secure. So he would never, he just got rid of TeamViewer. He's like, I don't trust it. And then, like, it was a few months after we were going back and forth about that all this stuff about TeamViewer came out. So it was definitely a told you so moment, but definitely you're the first person I've heard personally that's been impacted by it. So
yeah, well, it highlights the importance of two-factor. And so now I went back into LastPass and began to find all those accounts that have similar passwords, you know, that routine you go through every so often if you're a LastPass user or whatever, and started cleaning things up and really highlighted, you know, the importance of two-factor.
Yeah. So the good news for folks, were you going to say something, Aruna?
Oh, no.
The good news about TeamViewer is that if you are not if you've used TeamViewer and you're not sure if you've been breached, I mean, obviously in Jim's case, his bank account was losing dollars, so like he knew, but it's potential that maybe there's a passive TeamViewer person hanging out. You can go to the in Windows and Mac, depending on, you know, where it's installed, but you can go to the TeamViewer folder. And there is a log file called connections_incoming.txt, and it will show you all the incoming connections that have ever come in on TeamViewer and what the IP addresses were. So you can basically go through that and make sure you recognize all the connections that are in that log. And if there's a log that you don't recognize, then you might be concerned. But at least there's a kind of intuitive way for you to check without... you know, freaking out, wondering, oh, is it possible that at some point this got breached?
Yeah. The other thing, Christian, I've done is started shutting off LastPass, logging out every night. So, because, you know, again, that's another gigantic thing. If they're on your desktop and your LastPass is signed in and working, they have access to everything. It's the worst possible nightmare. You know, Mike Howard's saying he missed it. How'd they get the money? Well, they broke in through TeamViewer. And that is the biggest possible nightmare that when you think about somebody gaining access to your PC. And if regularly, I'll go to bed and just leave my browsers open. And, you know, of course, everything's logged in. So I've kind of gotten into the habit afterwards now. Just make sure TeamViewer's logged out. I'm maybe a little more like Franz and a little less like Jim before to just leave that stuff kind of open. But it is a little scary, you know, just to get back to that malware. You know, what are people more concerned about? Malware, ransomware, you know, those kind of physical attacks on your PC, as opposed to, oh, if I send this email, will somebody read it? You know, or, for the average guy when we think about it. So yeah, those are the warnings I'd give people. It's very real. And if, you know, imagine if I was gone, I caught it right away. Imagine if I had been gone for a couple days and didn't have access. And, you know, the other thing is, like with PayPal, God, do not connect your credit cards to PayPal. You know, disk it. Only do it when you absolutely have to, or if you're, you know, those kinds of things. Make sure you're being careful about what's connected to your account. So if they go in, they've got to work hard to get to it. The harder it is, like you said, the harder it is, the less they'll move on to the next easy guy.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm actually looking at some of the logs now, and it's amazing how many attempts there are.
Attempts?
Oh yeah.
So they're logging, are those external attempts to?
It looks like it. I see a lot of messages that say get user token, and it basically says, exception caught while querying user token, and it says failed. So there's a lot of repeat messages for it tries to connect, and then it says query token failed, which to me is a cryptic way of saying someone tried to log in and it didn't work.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my scenario, I had on my mom's PC, and the PC's in the house, and you use it for convenience. And you know, Sarah would be like, "Oh, hey, could you do something for me?" And so you just log into the PC and do it. And you can't anymore. You know, I just stay logged out. There's really no reason to stay logged at that point. Just log it out. If I need it again, I'll tell her, "Hey, turn your thing on. I'm going to connect," and just do it in that. So I think that opens up way too big of a attack surface when you don't
need. Yeah. No, definitely. But yeah, that's a world-class attack surface for you.
Yeah, it's gigantic. I mean, it is just gigantic, and you know, John had put in the chat a link to that. They're being hacked in bulk, and still nobody knows how at this point, which is a little scary. Like they've gotten, you know, like they've been working on this for a while and have gotten in. So it's a little scary. It's one of those really very, very to this group that listens to this, you know, that listens to this podcast. I think it's very relevant because we're all, I shouldn't say all, but most of us are TeamViewer users. And most of us are LastPass users, and they have the keys to the kingdom. They get through there, boom, you're dead. Yeah. They will get everything. And it's super scary. I mean, I quickly changed everything. You know, I almost made me want to set up some hierarchies of, like, here's all my bank accounts so I can quickly get to them. Those, because that's first priority, right? Let's change all. I went as far as changing the usernames, the user IDs on my bank accounts just to make sure those hadn't got, because you don't know. It's like, someone walked through your house, and you don't know if they took pictures of everything.
Yeah, exactly.
No, anyways, it's pretty scary. But one of those things, I think for us talking on this show, very important to kind of keep in mind. The anonymous stuff is great and super interesting, but the physical stuff is super scary, right. All by itself.
Yeah.
You know. So,
yeah.
Christian, anything else, or should we wrap it?
Yeah, I think that's a wrap. Now I'm all just. I'm still shivering a little bit about TeamViewer. I don't know if I can carry on.
It's the first thing that's ever really made me worry about security. Like, all the other stuff is like, yeah.
I think I would trust the Microsoft Remote Desktop Protocol a lot more, even though, like, that's the thing. Why did TeamViewer become popular? Because it was so difficult for people to set up Remote Desktop Protocol and make it, you know, user-friendly for folks to, you know, get their router set up for forwarding and all that. I'll just leave it at a pain, because otherwise bad words start coming out. But, you know, that's why TeamViewer was popular, because I was like, oh, bidink, I get this free connection, it's super easy to log in, I don't have to worry about the router. You know, it was, it's definitely a perfect example of, is it free? Is it convenient? Oh, great, I'm going to do it. Should I care about security? Not until there's a problem.
Yeah, but I think a lot of it can be overcome with two-factor. So immediately when you turn that on, the first time somebody hits it from something outside of the network, boom, it's gonna pop up that box. And it's six characters, six numbers they got to guess, right, from that standpoint. And it just adds, it's difficult, right? I mean, it makes it more difficult, and I think they move on. So I'm still going to use the tool. I'm just going to put two new things in place to tighten it up, to dual factor and turn the damn thing off. You don't need it on all the time, you know? So anyways, any other thoughts, either one of you, on that before we close it? All right, we're good. All right, good stuff. Well, hey, we're off and running, and I don't know. We'll try and do another one of these here pretty quick, but maybe we won't wait 6 months before we do it again. Christian, good to have you back. back on as well. Remind everyone that we, of course, we appreciate you guys supporting us, what you do here on, man, it's been so long since I've closed this show. I have no idea what I'm saying here, Christian. We'll have to come back. So we appreciate your support of the program by using our Amazon affiliate link. Go to theaverageguy.tv/Amazon. Every little bit helps when you're out there getting that done. And we're going to be talking about these on the next program. So if you just want to get one in advance or at least have that checked out, you can do that as well. We what else do we want to say? I just want to remind you that, of course, Cyber Frontiers is hosted and runs on Maple Grove Partners. And to get secure, reliable, awesome high-speed hosting from people you know and trust, very safe and secure. And I think WordPress, like dynamite, right? It's great for WordPress, Christian, probably. Yep. Optimize is the word I'm looking for WordPress. If you're a podcaster or even just looking for a blog, you might want to check it out, maplegrovepartners.com, and plans start as little as $10 a month for some great, seriously fast hosting. Trust me, I do some stuff on Azure with WordPress, just the free stuff, just to make sure I know how to do it, because I'm a Microsoft guy. Christian, it's not running half as fast as this stuff. So
we aim to please.
I know. Yeah, I like it. So, all right, with that, we'll say if you like this, share it, and we'll be back with another Cyber Frontiers, and with that, we'll say goodbye.